Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 5 of Tim's Travails, where this wonderful former IP attorney and author interviews other attorneys, especially with an emphasis on international law. So today's guest you are going to absolutely love, Chuni T. Wright. She is a law firm owner and the former assistant U.S. attorney in the District of Columbia. She is the firm's, her firm's practice areas include intellectual property protection and enforcement, trademark and copyright, of course, technology law and adventure trade law. So we are thrilled to learn more about what adventure trade law is and all the other things. DC is, it's August 2025, so DC is very much up in the news and China as well. So I'll kick it over to Tim and we can't wait to hear what you all have to teach us today.
Well, thank you, Hope, and it's great to see Chuni. It's been a few weeks since we saw each other, maybe a few months, but she's been traveling a lot this year and been staying very busy. And I'll be honest, I can't remember when we first met. I think you were working at the Entertainment Software Association probably, and we would probably see each other at meetings of one sort or another downtown. But a lot has happened since then. And so one of the big questions for me, because obviously we first met when we were both doing intellectual property, copyrights, trademarks, and so forth, and you do that kind of law, but then you've taken those tentacles and reached out into an area I know nothing about, and it's something called adventure travel law. And it sounds to me that bringing intellectual property, copyrights, trademark, and so on, along with somehow attaching to adventure travel law. How does that work? Or how did it even happen?
Well, thanks for having me on today, Tim and Hope. And a great question. Everybody's so curious about that part of my practice. I say IP, adventure travel, or technology, and it's, oh, what's adventure travel? Based on my bio, you know, I've worked in traditional sort of environments for many years before starting my own practice in 2010. So I worked at big firms in the Bay Area. I was a litigator. I was an assistant U.S. attorney. Mm-hmm. I was at the Entertainment Software Association doing global enforcement, protecting the intellectual property rights of major video game companies. So in thinking about what kind of practice I wanted, I didn't want to just build places I'd been to. What's the point? I have to say, it's a lot easier just to get the paycheck. So I wasn't trying to just create the same thing that I'd been at. Yeah. I really thought about the kind of practice I wanted to build. And what I wanted to do was combine my legal expertise in those areas, copyright, trademark, enforcement, litigation, and bring in the things that I love to do outside of work, because I work really hard. Yeah. I accepted that truth about myself. And I wanted to bring in and have part of my day-to-day work life the things I enjoy. And what I really love is traveling, getting exposure to cultures. I love to be active. I'm not good at being the beach bum, maybe for an hour or two, but then I have to get up and move around. Exploration and also conservation. I feel strongly about protecting this world that we live in. And so I wanted to really sort of custom fit my practice to me. And so, Tim, I didn't know what I was doing when I said I wanted to bring in travel. I went through a course in DC, they offer it through the DC Bar Association. It's a great resource. Daniel Mills runs this, and you get to sort of spend time with Daniel, go through this course and think about like what a practice would look like. I dusted this paper off that I drafted 15 years ago about what type of clients you want to work with. And I put travel. I put these niches, scuba diving companies, tech companies and the like. And you know what? I made it happen. And so I think it really happened because I knocked on some doors. Again, found some of these adventure travel trade association groups online. I sent an email to info@adventuretraveltradeassociation.com. I got a response, and the rest is history.
Well, that's interesting. So it's I then getting into it in a way is just, I don't know, just you just send emails and say, hey, does anybody respond and have start a conversation and see where it goes, huh?
I mean, essentially, I had done some research into adventure travel, just the industry itself. I think it helped that I came from a trade association, so
Yeah.
I wondered if there was a trade association for this industry. And I did this prior to actually officially leaving my job. I did
Yeah.
some research before I did that. And about a year into starting my own practice, I mean, the first year was deer in the headlights. I mean, anybody who's done this, who's listening, they know the feeling. Anybody who's thinking about it, the first year, you're doing things like getting your LLC. Tim, you've probably
Yeah.
done this, hope, getting your LLC or getting your
Yep.
corporate form. You're trying to figure out how you do taxes now. I mean, all the mechanics. And then you're having a lot of nice lunches, which was great. I miss those days.
Well, as long as you're having income to pay for those lunches, it's fine.
Oh, it takes a while. It takes a
Yeah.
while. It does take a while. But it, and I miss those days of lunches and, you know, less work and more lunches.
So, but
But
let me, can I ask a quick question then?
yeah.
You have mentioned scuba diving, and is that something that you used as a way into the adventure travel area?
I mentioned it, but I had done some other things as well. I think it was simply I, about a year into being out on my own, I looked at this document I had drafted about the kinds of clients I wanted to work with. And I really spent that first year, networking and meeting people in the world that I knew, in the IP world, in the enforcement world. And about a year into it, when I looked at this piece of paper, my business plan, I realized I had done nothing to foster adventure travel. So, based on my research, I knew there was a trade association. It works differently than the DC Trade Association. It's not a
Okay.
policy or lobbying group. It's really a business group, networking. They work a lot with destinations that want to highlight their adventure offerings.
Yeah.
Right? So, for instance, there was a conference in Tuscany because Tuscany is known for culture and wine, but you can also ride a bicycle through the Tuscan hills. You can do all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I understood that there was this trade association, and I just reached out and said, I'm a lawyer, I do like adventure. I talked about scuba diving just to give some bona fides.
Yeah.
And at that time, they really wanted to give more legal resources to these adventure travel companies that need legal help. They're sending people all over the world. This is something you do, Tim, and hope. You know, as travelers, you know, you go to places and there are risks. They're
Yes.
huge risks sometimes. Yeah, I know. Tim, you've probably done something pretty risky. I don't
I've
know.
done
If you're...
well, I would say I've done stupid things, yes.
You've done stupid. Okay, risky and stupid. They're
You
not
know,
mutually exclusive. Often they're
I've done a
mutually
couple of things
exclusive.
where I think you should start doing those things when you're about 30 years younger than I am. You know, I waited till I was a lot older, and then as after I'm done doing that, I'm thinking, you know, that was a pretty crazy thing to be doing at this point in life. But yeah, it's a, you know, it's a good thing. I'm not talking to an insurance person who would charge me a ton for a policy to protect myself.
Right, for sure. But there's certainly plenty of insurance companies. Yeah, if you ever do, I want to talk to anybody. But that is something that I deal with respect to these companies. We talk about insurance issues. But anyway, it was just a time where they wanted to have some legal speakers come talk about risk management, talk about contracts.
Yeah.
So that's how I started my relationship
Yeah.
with the trade association. I am now on the board and started working with independent companies
Yeah.
that are sending people around. And yeah, it just happened that way. I never expected to get a response to him, you know, from the president of the association. We laugh
But
about it
yeah.
now.
I mean, it certainly gives you a whole different world of interesting people that you're now in contact with and having, you know, some interaction with, not only on a business from a business perspective, but certainly it does add to what I would say the fun side of talking about new adventures to undertake if you're one of those kinds of travelers, right? Going somewhere and doing something maybe you hadn't thought about doing before. So, and I think that's part of the travel. it's not just the work itself, but then actually experiencing the travel and the things you do when you are doing the travel. And that gets me to the next thing is, you mentioned that you've been to about 60 countries. I would have thought it was more. I know to a lot of people, 60 countries is a lot of countries to go to, but I guess in my mind, I just thought it'd be more than 60. But all right, what are the different things that got you to that high number of countries visited, both between whether it's work, whether it's pleasure travel, adventure travel? How does that happen?
Sure, and I think it is actually over 60, Tim. I don't have the latest count, but it's over 60 somewhere in there. So my travel journey really started early. I have to credit my parents. It started not in the United States, but abroad. So my mother's Korean. I was born in Asia, so it started, as an infant. And because my father was in the military, we lived in different countries. And so after we left Asia, we moved to the United States. And I spent a handful of years in northern Italy. I don't know what my father did right. I'm glad he did it. We lived in a very lovely town called Vicenza, which is about an hour west of Venice. So I learned to ski there. I learned culture. It was just great. So travel wasn't just sightseeing in my life. It was really part of my upbringing. I think, but once I hit college and grad school and then worked, it didn't really snowball until probably right after 9/11. Before that, I'd done what everybody else had done, try to eke out some time for vacation. It was really hard. I didn't have really the time as a litigator in San Francisco and DC. The cases come first, the work comes first. So I would take a week vacation here and there. I think I started in Mexico with some friends right out of law school. I went to the British Virgin Islands when I was a prosecutor because the BVI sounded more international than the US Virgin Islands. So we went there. And then I took the opportunity between a couple of jobs to do longer trips. So I did one to Hawaii. This was between jobs going, I was leaving San Francisco to join the U.S. Attorney's Office in D.C., and I wanted to take the opportunity to go to Hawaii, which was much closer to San Francisco then. And that really taught me about solo travel, which I didn't really ever think about or think I could do, but nobody could really go at that time. So it was really eye-opening. And then I took another trip when I left the U.S. Attorney's Office to go back to the Bay Area, this time to the Silicon Valley. And I did a 3-week overland. I went out by myself, but joined up a tour group with three other people. And we did a 3-week overland from Johannesburg to Cape Town. Yeah, so that was really the extent of my travel, probably the first 7 years of leaving law school. And then right after 9/11, I left my law firm job and to travel right when 9/11 happened. So my timing was just horrible. And that's where it really snowballed, Tim. I traveled to a number of countries. I took 7 months, spent a lot of time in Asia, and then went off to Europe. And I'd never taken time off before. So that was new to me. I wasn't one of those backpackers in my 20s. I was pseudo backpacking in my 30s.
So during those 7 months, where are some of the let's say maybe off the beaten path kind of places did you go to?
Well, I started off in Nepal. So that was the longest trip ever at that point I'd ever taken, flying to Kathmandu. Took forever. And then I did the Everest Base Camp trek there, which was off the beaten path. It was really off the beaten path then because it was right after 9/11. I think I left around September 26th. And if you remember, we weren't going anywhere. Right, we weren't getting on planes. We certainly weren't going in the direction of Afghanistan at all.
No.
And so I'd say Nepal and Kathmandu. Then I went to India and went all as far as you could go. I went all the way to a town called Jaisalmer, which is close to the Pakistan border. And so there were not very many Americans traveling at that time. I
Yeah.
could probably count on one hand the number of Americans I saw around
Yeah.
in those parts of the world. So, but it was a really interesting time to
Yeah.
travel.
Well, I can tell you on 9/11 itself, I actually landed in Tokyo on 9/11.
Really?
And I was in Japan for a 2-week business trip. And of course, we that there were no international flights coming into the US or very many other places at that point for a while. But what was really strange was by the time I was supposed to come home, flights were coming back into the US. And I remember getting on the plane in Tokyo to come home, and I'm on a big 747, and I had a business class seat in the upper deck. And the flight attendant said to me, "Well, any pieces of luggage you carried on, just put it under the seat across the aisle under that seat." And I looked at her like, "Why would I do that? I mean, there are going to be other people." Well, actually, of the 400 seats on this 747 from Tokyo back to, I can't remember where the direct flight was coming into, I think out of those 400 seats, there might have been 25 of us on the plane. So the flight crew basically outnumbered us, or about the same number of flight crew as passengers on that flight. So, I mean, I remember that it was I think it was ANA, not Japan Airlines. And so I basically took a lot of free time and just had, I practiced my Japanese with the flight crew because they were just standing around with absolutely nothing to do because the flight was pretty much empty, you know. So it was a nice chance for me to practice Japanese with them. So it was actually a nice flight, you know. You got whatever you wanted and
Right.
however much of it you wanted. So it was a bad time to travel, but at the same time, you know, if you were traveling, it really wasn't the worst time to be traveling. Because of things like that.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there were I mean, I found the same. It's so interesting that experience. You saw it, you had a unique experience at that time, and 14 hours, 12 hours of private Japanese lessons, which is really
It's
nice.
not bad.
But I found the same. I think it really helped me sort of look at world news in a more inquisitive way, look at US news in a more inquisitive way. I think relating to people, seeing the real devastation where tourism collapses in places, walking around a place like Kathmandu and all the shopkeepers are sitting there like everybody's gone now. And I think we've seen echoes of that. Or, real incidents like that, since then. And there's nothing like being on the ground and seeing something like that. I feel like even India, I took a Southeast Asia class in college. And so you always hear about the population and the enormous population in India. But I really didn't appreciate it until I got to India. And so I think seeing it and understanding it, and having that sort of experience, I think has just been absolutely critical, just personally, but also as a lawyer, which I'm sure, Tim, you probably found having that cultural,
Well, I mean, traveling to, you know, so many different places, and they are different. I mean, I've gone to some countries that, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to find them on a map even years ago. I mean, spending 3 weeks in Armenia was not something I would have ever been on my mind, nor 4 or 5 trips to the Republic of Georgia and places like that. So it's going to places that people really don't ever even think about. I mean, there are some places you always hear about, and then there are other places you'll never hear about. And getting to some of these places that people never hear about at all is really different because I think you get there, the environment is completely different. You don't know what to expect at all. So it's not in the mainstream of people's conscious thinking of, oh, this is a place I go to, right? If you're going to leave the United States and go somewhere, whether it's on business or even on vacation, Republic of Georgia or Uzbekistan or Armenia are just not places that pop up on people's lists. So it is a little strange when you find yourself in these places. And frankly, you really don't have any, you know, prior thinking about ever having to go to these places. So yeah, it's a little unusual when that happens. So amongst some of these treks that you've had, do those include the couple that you'd say really are up there in your memories as far as whether it's just challenges or whatever, however special they might have been?
Sure. I mean, Everest Base Camp was incredible. I think I just read Into Thin Air a handful of months before I knew I was going. So I couldn't believe I was actually there. But that was the first time I was in high altitude hiking. I hiked in California and other places. So kind of learning what that was about, being in the culture, seeing how your body does. We met some doctors along the way that were studying Sherpas and how they acclimatize, which was interesting because you always hear about acclimatizing with Westerners, but the Sherpas who are actually carrying the gear, the equipment, all of those things, they also experience altitude sickness. And it was interesting talking to those doctors. So that whole experience was amazing. I loved it. And I also did Kilimanjaro a handful of years ago
Yep, I
in
remember you talking about
2017.
that. Yep.
Commemorate a birthday. That was high altitude, but totally different. It was a 1 week trek instead of a 3 week trek, and then you had to like slide down ash because you're climbing to the top of a volcano. So I heard going down was really hard, but in my head I had rubble and rocks. No, you're sliding. And I was traveling with a friend, and so the guide kept telling her, "It's like skiing. It's like skiing," as we're sleep deprived, trying to come down. And she said, "I'd never been skiing." So it's like, well, this is really going to work. We got to the bottom. It worked out fine. But really, just there's nothing like being in such immense beauty, pushing yourself, the challenges, right? Where you're not feeling 100%. And just going to places that you have to go by foot. You're relying on yourself. I did something recently. This was about a month ago for my birthday, where I went rafting in the Grand Canyon
Ah,
National Park.
okay.
A week in the Grand Canyon. I went with a company called Oars, which is one of the pioneering companies, with a really just an incredible legacy in river conservation. But it was pretty unforgettable. We hiked, we left the raft midpoint. We didn't do the full Colorado River in the Grand Canyon. And then we hiked up 4,500 feet in about 6 hours up the Bright Angel Trail. I was kind of terrified in advance because I heard it could be super hot. You could pass out. You could have heat exhaustion, but I think I did a bunch of training here in DC.
Oh, okay.
And it was just right. It was great. But one of the experiences that just really hits home with respect to, how fragile our environment can be is we got to one campsite and I started feeling sprinkles, dry sprinkles. So I was looking around wondering, what is this? And there were little ashes that were being blown in from there's fires going on the North Rim. They've had to evacuate. It's been really devastating in that area. And so it was raining ashes, which I'd never had that experience before. And so it was memorable for the sheer beauty. It was great for the week being on the river. We had some really wonderful experiences, but then I think there were also reminders of what's happening to the environment. But that was pretty fun.
So when we talk about all these different activities, whether it's rafting, whether it's, trekking up Kilimanjaro or anything like that, and the companies that you may, any person who's thinking about doing these things, is thinking about doing, where does the legal stuff come in for the company that's offering you these wonderful opportunities to possibly go out and do crazy things, right? I mean, how much consultation or advising as far as the legal side goes, well, wait a minute. I want to know, how old is this client of mine going to, what is their physical medical situation and how much am I taking on as a company if I do these things for somebody? And it doesn't really matter what the age is. I mean, you want people that are hopefully physically fit and can do these things, but there's that big but.
Right. And this is Adventure Travel Law, Tim. So if you're interested in joining this arena with me, you are very welcome. but those are some of the kinds of issues that we grapple with. I want to take a second just to define what adventure travel is, because I don't think there, I think we all have ideas what that is, but the trade association, the definition of adventure travel is travel that involves at least two of the following three elements. So one is nature, culture, and physical activity. So it's not just physical activity. And it doesn't have to be hardcore. There's soft adventures where maybe you're doing a hut-to-hut hike in Switzerland, right? It kind of meets those criteria, but you're staying in lovely inns or lodges, having delicious meals. This isn't, you know, hella skiing and you're eating granola bars, you know, as you're flying down a hill. I don't know. So adventure travel really is a lot of the travel that everyday people do.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would say adventure travel law is really sort of an industry-based practice area where the legal work that I provide supports these businesses and companies that are operating in the adventure, outdoor, and experiential travel arena. I work mostly with tour operators, which are a little different than, let's say, travel agents, right?
Yeah.
You might reach out to a travel agent to get a spot on a cruise, or a travel agent to get you booked on some excursion. Tour operators do sales, they sell their trips, but they take on more risk than a travel agent because they're the ones putting together a trip in another destination. So we deal with typical things, contracts, right? Waivers, terms and conditions, supplier agreements, indemnification agreements, insurance, and the like. We also deal with regulation and compliance, or our laws called seller of travel laws that exist in a handful of states that actually extend to companies that aren't based in the state but sell or advertise to companies in their state. We do IP. So I always push people, companies, to think about brand protection. And brand value, right? Let's get your marks registered. Let's get them registered in different countries. And dispute resolution and litigation, as well as crisis and risk management. So on your point about are people sufficiently suited to a trip, we make sure that terms and conditions, and any reputable tour operator should be working with the lawyer to some degree. And the terms will address these things, but behind the scenes, we're talking about these things, such as, well, should the company have certain requirements? Should we impose requirements based on age?
Yeah.
Will that feel discriminatory? Would have, you know, what's true, what we're assuming about older travelers, like me.
Like me.
Could be true for younger. So should it be age dependent? And what we're actually finding, and this has come up in a number of conversations, is that some of the trips are really available to people who have the means, and usually that means older. And sometimes there's a mismatch where someone thinks they can do something that they could do maybe 10 years ago and they can't. Someone was giving an example of, in some countries, you have squat toilets.
Yeah.
And people don't realize that, and they end up in a country and they can't physically do it.
Right.
They need an
right.
escort to the bathroom. And how do you handle that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that gets down. Well, I will say the one example I have, and you know, you know that we go on a lot of cruises, and we were in Papua New Guinea a couple of years ago. And now the cruise line sets up all these excursions. They're not the provider, but they're the ones through whom we have to pay for and, you know, acquire a spot for an excursion. And they work with the actual provider. And we had this wonderful description of a hike going up a hill or a small mountain, more a hill than a mountain. But the description was that it would be up and back in an hour. In an hour. Okay.
That
Now,
sounds doable.
Papua New Guinea, we're talking about a place where the temperature is over 90 degrees. And if you think about a humid day in DC in the summer, that's what it's like.
No,
And
yeah. You
yeah,
can't walk 5 minutes in that, Tim.
so I signed up for this thing thinking, okay, it's going to be an hour. It's okay, no big deal. I mean, I work out pretty regular. And so we go out, and I think we started with roughly 25 people. And the other thing was that, they had a scale, three, four dots of how difficult this is. I think this was like two dots, no more than three. It should have been seven. And the reason I say that is I was kind of at the front end of a group of 25 people. There were six or seven of us that tended to stay up in the front area, and there tended to be a gap. We did not realize that within the first 20 minutes, we'd already lost four or five. And within the first 30 minutes, we lost a good half. At the beginning, it was a very gradual slope.
Okay.
But of course, we had a local guy who did this every day, and maybe he could do it up and back in an hour. But I will tell you that at the hour and 45-minute mark, we were still going up.
Wow.
Yeah, and I think at that point, now at this point, I had a real thin long pants and long sleeve shirt simply because of the environment. I didn't want to be exposed. And I had Timberland boots. But by the time we got to this hour and 45-minute mark, our guide had gone back to see what was going on with people at the back end. Well, we didn't realize that by then there were only about seven of us anyway, out of the starting group of about 25. And he finally caught up to us because he said, "Oh, you guys keep going and I'll go check." And when by the time he came back, I'd stopped for about 10 minutes, and I was just doing a body check and realized, I said, "Wait a minute, how much farther is this going to be?" And he kept saying, "Oh, 10 minutes." Well, in fact, for the people that actually got to the actual top, which was only about four people out of the whole group, I was not one of them. It took another half an hour.
Wow.
And so it was over 2 hours to go up. And this thing had been described as an hour to go up and down. Now, you got to go down, right? And like you said about coming down, I can tell you coming down was much worse than the going up. And by the time I got back, there was nothing, including my Timberland boots, that was dry on me. It took my
Wow.
Timberland boots 3 days to dry out because of the humidity and so on. And it was, I got back to the ship and actually spoke to the excursion people and said, "You're very fortunate we had no medical emergencies because there was no way to get to people up on that hill." Because by the time we got to where I stopped, it was a pretty steep climb. It was not a hill anymore, not a gradual sloping hill. It was a steep climb. I mean, if you could grab onto a limb or something to help pull yourself up, you did that. And most of the people that started on this, I would say the average age was probably over 60, which is why we didn't realize that there had been people that turned around, went back, and actually got a ride back to the ship before we ever got back.
Wow.
And so the whole thing actually took, instead of an hour, it was about a 3.5, 4 hour excursion ended up being that way if you were there for the whole time. And that's where, like, there's a difference, as you say, between a travel agent and the actual provider of that event, that tour or whatever. Those are two different things. And in our case, we had the ship and their excursion staff who provide the description, through whom you schedule and pay, because then they turn around and pay the actual, operator of that particular tour. And I said, "You guys have to get this thing right, because if you'd had a medical emergency today, there would have been a big problem. A
Right,
big problem."
and that sounds, I mean, that's the very kind of thing you don't want happening any trip, right? And just to add like a second term is provider. So in my world of tour operators who, let's say, are maybe in the United States, they are hiring these providers. So it's the same scenario. The cruise line is sort of, in this example, sort of in kind of similar issues as a tour operator where you're hiring a provider and there are questions about like, we need this tour description to be accurate. Like you cannot have a 1 hour description and it become a 4 hour adventure. Or if it's truly an hour at certain times of the year, then you have to know that. And you have to warn people and you can't just take people up and yeah, that could have been disastrous. People have come down, they didn't get the benefit of the trip, but if they'd gotten hurt or you know, a number of things or heat stroke and so it really is imperative, and that's what I work with tour operators on is making sure we're mitigating the risk to some degree, right? They're relying on providers in other countries and vetting those providers, making sure that they have all of the information and then making decisions about you know, what should be offered, what shouldn't be offered, what do your marketing materials say? But it is pretty shocking that the description was so far off, Tim. You know, I don't know the details beyond, but that's, yeah.
No, I, you know, my when I got back, my lawyer brain kicked in and I went and talked to them and I said, you know, in the future, if you, I put you on notice about this particular excursion, I mean, if something had happened to anybody afterwards, they'd be, I mean, for me as an American lawyer, I'd sue the pants off of them, right? And the
Right.
bad thing was, we actually had a person on that excursion who was an emergency room doctor. But here's the problem. I mean, he turned around, he told me about 20 minutes in, because he was, even if we had him on the excursion with us and something had happened up on that hill, he wouldn't have been able to get and help that person because he couldn't make it.
Right.
So
You're right. And then that puts that person in a really difficult position because now you're getting into like Good Samaritan laws, or should he? I mean, he would do what a doctor would do. I think if he was faced with it, he would render the aid, but who wants to be in that position?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
I
there are
mean,
just
that.
so many things about that whole thing that day that just, you know, you stop and think about how crazy it really could have been. It could have been horrible. If the worst had happened, it could have been very, very bad that day. But
Right. We try to avoid those situations. You know, sometimes things do happen, right? There is some risk. You know, we've had situations where I don't know, somebody might yeah, have a medical emergency. It just happens. But other times, yeah, we've had you know, more you know, dealt with crisis situations where they call me and I kind of help them strategically what to do.
So, well, now that we've talked a little bit about what adventure law is, let me get to the last point that, because I know we maybe time-wise we seem to have covered lots of things. And so, if you're an entrepreneur or company, and you're into tech or leading people up mountains, what's the legal advice you give in those two totally separate and distinct areas, bringing them together?
So yeah, like going up mountains and what kind of advice? You know, one of the things that actually hiking up mountains sort of taught me, and it's counterintuitive. There's a saying that hike high, sleep low. And it's so that your body can acclimatize, right? And it's really, again, counterintuitive because you're going up and you think you keep going up, but you have to come down so that you can actually exceed where you've gone, like, you know, before and like push to the summit. And I think whenever I think about sort of any business, whether it's travel or another, is you know, it's not this hike high, sleep low really isn't just an altitude role. It really applies to business. It's really, I think, a role around resilience, right? And that means you take a step back, you pause, whether it's to protect your brand, whether it's to protect your travelers, whether it means to address other legal risks. And so I always say, you know, you You go high and you also step back and sleep low, but taking a moment, and not always pushing, pushing, pushing without really having a plan for it.
Yeah. No, I think that's it's a good perspective. I mean, you've been able to take what you do physically to test yourself, let's say, in some of these adventures, but then taking the time when you step back and say, well, what are we doing? Why are we doing this? And how should we do this the right way? I think
Right.
that's the other part of it, right? It's not just keep pushing forward, but stepping back, take a moment. How do we do it the right way? I mean, for me, I'll put this in, for me, it's a different context these days. It's like as I'm trying to write something right now, it's like every evening, at the worst time, it starts to pop up that I can't go to sleep for a half an hour because I've thought about what I wrote today or yesterday. And all of a sudden I'm thinking, okay, how do I tie it to the next scene? But it's as I'm writing, that doesn't happen. It's always after I sit down or take a break or I'm on the treadmill or whatever, or I'm trying to go to sleep. And all of a sudden, the only thing I'm thinking about is what's the next scene after what I wrote today. And so it's kind of the same concept. You go up, you do X, and then you come back and, let the body rest and let the mind rest and get prepared for the next day. So it's that concept. I think it applies to so many things, right?
Right, it does. And I think a lot of times for us, right, we feel like, oh, it's a step back. If I'm slowing down, if I take a moment, if I pause,
Yeah.
if I'm hiking high and if I go low, am I losing ground?
Yeah.
And no, you're actually strengthening. And I think
Yeah.
that comes, with everything, right? It's the whole rest concept. If you're working out, you have rest days and your body is actually getting stronger. It doesn't
Yeah.
mean you're getting weaker. You need that time because something else is happening.
Yeah.
Fortifying everything that you're doing. And sometimes it's easy to lose sight of that. And I think in business, you probably see this a lot of times. Businesses are going fast. They don't always
Yeah.
want to stop and slow down to look at some of these things, ask these questions. Maybe look at their marketing materials and think about whether this 1 hour jaunt is a 5 hour harrowing
Yeah.
trip.
Well, I will say that that particular day made me stop and think. It's one of those things you do when you're about 30 years younger. You don't wait till you are at my age to start doing these things. So,
I don't know. Sometimes you do. The day you stop doing it, Tim, is the day, life becomes a little less fun. But I hear you. Sometimes, when I was doing the Bright Angel Trail, I was like, yeah, this is great. And but is there a point where you stop doing this? And I had a neighbor ask me that. When are you going to stop diving? When do you stop doing these things? I said, I don't know.
No, your
I'm
body
just doing
sometimes
it.
will tell you. Yeah, your body will
Tim's
tell you
doing
when,
it. Why should I stop? As long as Tim's doing it, we're good.
No,
But
don't follow me as that. No, I'm not that example.
but I will. Oh,
Yeah.
sorry.
Go
Well, I would
ahead.
say that I think one, because I think in my practice, a lot of times people don't see how these parts come together,
Yeah.
and I think the common thread for me, because when I look at my clients, and the work that I do, I feel like there is a strong commonality. I don't feel like I'm going from one totally different industry to another totally different industry when I'm working with travel versus tech versus maybe a creator. And, I would say I work with businesses, companies, people that are at the cutting edge of their field. And I think that's what's so exciting about it. They're all at the cutting edge. They're pushing on their respective frontiers. And so I actually came up with a tagline for my firm called Charting the Way for Trailblazers. And it's so sort of in my DNA that I didn't even realize that it mirrors my initials, CTW. We were brainstorming and then a teammate said, those are your initials. He said, oh, really? Okay. It must really be a part of me. But I think one of the things, I would share in terms of listeners who might be thinking about starting their own practice or forging ahead on a new career path, it's scary. It's very nerve-wracking and probably for you, Tim, and doing your thing. And oh, I mean, we've all had our journeys. It was a scary thing to go start my own practice and leave the comfort of a job. But I think, it's really, I think, very gratifying to just not follow a model that exists for someone else's model. And I think the lesson here, and I think we all embody that, is, think about what you know the best. Think about what you care about, what you're passionate about, and where those things intersect. And that's where you'll find like the kind of practice or career that's not just sustainable, but meaningful.
Yeah. No, it's a great way to come to the conclusion of a very interesting discussion about not just law, but, just travel in general and the challenges and all the things that can happen. It's all fun stuff. And maybe we'll be able to revisit after some more trips.
Oh, that would be great.
talk about some other strange things that can happen.
Yes, I feel like we could talk for hours.
We probably could.
We know we could. but I so enjoyed being here today. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate you giving us the time to do it. So stay well, travel, enjoy, have a good time. And hopefully we might be able to talk about this on a different, maybe AI or something else down the road. So we'll see.
I would love to.
All
yes,
right.
I'd be
Sounds
happy
good.
To come back. So
okay.
Thank
Well,
you so
between
much.
now and then, we'll taste some wine together somewhere and
oh, yeah.
We can talk about.
Yeah, September, I think. Well, you'll be gone, but we'll figure it out.
Okay. You take care. Great,
okay,
great
too.
To have you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Hope. Okay.
Thank you to all of our readers, listeners, and viewers on Tim's Travails. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, very proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio and Incandescent TV. All right, to adventure of travel. Here's to it. Thank you, Tim.